They required a guarantee from the rest of the Constitutional Convention that the first order of business of the new Congress would be to write a Bill of Rights, those amendments, or they would not propose to their states that they ratify the Constitution. They got the guarantee, and in those days, they were men of honor, and they did just that. When they met for the first Congress, they wrote the first 10 amendments, sent them to the states, and they are our Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is not, I will say this again, the Bill of Rights is not a declaration of rights. It is a declaration of prohibitions against the federal government. The founders feared intervention by the federal government in the affairs of the states and the people. They did not want the federal government to serve as the watchdog over the state's responsibility to protect the rights of the people. The true purpose of the Bill of Rights is stated in its preamble, which is seldom included in a Constitution text, and it's sad every copy of the Constitution should have this preamble in it. The convention of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government, will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. The founders wanted to make very sure that they could help the courts avoid any misconstruction and add restrictive clauses to the Constitution to prevent government arrogance and abuse. So we're going to start with Amendment 1 tonight. Some of you probably haven't memorized. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. They considered freedom of religion a right that would brook no government interference. They wanted to make sure the government was not hostile to religion ever. People do not understand today how important religion was to the founding fathers. It was their primary motivator. It's why it's the very first thing that they talk about when they write an amendment to the Constitution. And if you read that first line again, it says, Congress shall make no law respecting, and it goes on from there. Remember what we talked about with the Constitution. Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says, all legislative power shall reside in a Congress comprised of two bodies. All legislative power. This was a declarative statement to put everybody on notice. Congress is the only one that can make legislation, and they were forever barred from legislating in these areas. And just to make sure that a guy in the 21st century is not misreading that, I'm going to give you a quote from Thomas Jefferson in the Kentucky Resolutions. Special provision has been made by one of the amendments to the Constitution, which expressly declares that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, and he goes on to the rest of the amendment, thereby guarding in the same sentence and under the same words the freedom of religion, of speech, and of the press, insomuch that whatever violates either throws down the sanctuary which covers the others, and that libels, falsehood, and defamation equally with heresy and false religion are withheld from the cognizance of federal tribunals. Folks, Thomas Jefferson said, Amendment 1 means what it says. The judiciary is to keep its hands off. They have no authority over the Bill of Rights. None. That was Thomas Jefferson. I agree with him. I read English, and I say that's exactly what this says. George Washington talked a little bit about religion. He said, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. They knew better. Can't happen. Look at the country today. The founders wanted religion taught in the schools, but they wanted it taught in such a way that the precepts of religion could be taught without any particular denomination or even religion. That there were precepts that could be taught in school and that they intended to be taught in school even today. Benjamin Franklin made 5 points when he talked about what should be taught in school. Number 1, recognition and worship of a creator who made all things. Number 2, the creator has revealed a moral code of behavior for happy living, distinguishing right and wrong. Number 3, the creator holds us responsible for the way we treat each other. Number 4, all mankind lives beyond this life. And number 5, in the next life, we are judged for the conduct in this one. They're really straightforward, and that is what they intended to be taught in the school. And there is nothing in that that would hurt or pressure anyone in any way. I said before that Alexis de Tocqueville toured this nation. He was very, very impressed with what he saw. And he wrote extensively about America and what he saw. And one of the things he had to say in his writings was, "I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors, her fertile fields, her rich mines, her vast world commerce. Not until I went to the churches of America did I understand the secret of her genius and power." This was a man who'd experienced the horrible things that happened in France with the French Revolution. He saw what was happening in Europe, and he could see they were headed a very different way than we were. Free speech, press, freedom of assembly, always, let me say this again, always will be targets of suspicion by government. They will always be under attack by government. If you read Amendment 1, I'm just going to give you one example, 501(c) legislation. 501(c) legislation as it's imposed on churches, not on other 501(c) organizations. 501(c) legislation violates establishment of religion because government tells the churches what they cannot talk about. Violates freedom of speech. It violates freedom of the press because a great many churches have a newsletter and they're not allowed to print anything political in those newsletters. It violates the very spirit of the right to assemble because the people assemble in a church to hear the leaders called by God talk to them about what God wants in our lives here, how what he wants affects our lives here, and that would include government and political figures. And it violates the right to petition government for redress of grievance because you cannot petition redress of a grievance. You're not allowed to err. So just one piece of legislation written by Congress violates everything in Amendment 1. The fact that they ever wrote the legislation, read it again, was an open violation of Amendment 1 because it says they can make no law respecting these. As we go on through the rest of these amendments, I want you to understand that the Founding Fathers spoke well, wrote well. When they wrote these amendments, they intended for us to understand that when Amendment 1 said Congress shall make no law respecting, that we were to understand that even though they didn't print it for every amendment, that is what they meant in all of the amendments in a Bill of Rights. That Congress make no law violating each and every one of these.
Dave, when was the 501(c)(3) implemented?
1954 by Lyndon Baines Johnson. He was angry because the independent Baptist churches in Texas had the temerity to question his honesty and integrity when he was running for office. And that's amazing. I mean, it could not possibly have been Lyndon Baines Johnson's fault that all those dead people voted in his elections.
That's in the Internal Revenue Code.
Yes.
Versus the one that...
Congress wrote it. Congress writes the tax code. IRS doesn't write the tax code. Boy, do they ever. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I want to look at Amendment 2, and later on I'm going to really focus some on Amendment 2 for a reason. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I told you before George Mason was considered the father of the Bill of Rights. He was asked, after the Bill of Rights was written, what was meant by Amendment 2, and his answer was, who is the militia? The whole people. Only a government bent on tyranny would seek to disarm the people. In U.S. code, every male between the ages of 17 and 45 is in the militia of their state. Did you know that? Under U.S. code, every male between the ages of 17 and 45 is in the militia of their state if they're at all able-bodied. If that code had been written today, it would be men and women between the ages of 17 and 45. All the people of this nation are the militia. All the people in this nation have the right to keep and to bear. Bear meaning to carry arms, period. The right to keep and bear arms under U.S. law and under our understanding of English law going back before the United States was a nation goes back to Alfred the Great. We talked about him that first week. He's the most respected king in English history. And when he was king, the order was given that all free Englishmen, from peasant on up, would purchase and own weapons. Now, for some of those people, their weapon was a great big scythe, but every able-bodied man in England from Alfred the Great on was supposed to own a weapon to defend their country. Men like Hitler, Mao, and Stalin all began their reigns by disarming the people. Always. It's the very first thing that tyrants do is convince you that society and your nation will be safer if you give up your right to bear arms. The very first case in the United States involving the Second Amendment was 1837. It's called Nunn versus the State of Georgia. State of Georgia outlawed all pistol sales, except for these giant things they call horse pistols. It made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that that law in Georgia was unconstitutional, stating that the whole people of this nation had the right to keep and bear arms. That case never needed to go to the Supreme Court again. They decided it in 1837. The people of this nation have the right to keep and bear arms. 1837, Nunn versus Georgia, N-U-N-N. Amendment 3 says that no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Whenever soldiers are quartered in a home, that places each home under martial law. And there is only one purpose for government quartering soldiers. That is intimidation. Now, I would submit to you in the 21st century that everyone in this room has had soldiers quartered in their home for years. If you use the internet, if you own a telephone, if you have a bank account, with electronic surveillance, the government has electronic soldiers in every home 24 hours a day. And the reason they have electronic soldiers in our homes is intimidation. And you know it's intimidation when they like to use lines like, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to be afraid of. They stole that one from King George. Do we have guys with guns in our house? No. But I would submit to you that with what government does with electronics, wiretaps, surveillance, that yes, every single one of us has had soldiers in our home for years. And for exactly the purpose of intimidation. Just my opinion, but I don't know that they did a lot of quartering during the Civil War. Lincoln did order the suspension of habeas corpus, which was ruled unconstitutional, at least in the way he did it, because only Congress can suspend habeas corpus. That's one of the things in Article 1. Lincoln tried a couple of things. He was the first one to give executive orders to the people of this nation, and the orders he gave were declared unconstitutional. But I don't remember the Union quartering soldiers. If the Union soldiers used houses as a base, the families didn't stay in the houses. Quartering soldiers means that they live in the house with you and watch you all the time they're there. Now, I do know that the military during time of war has taken homes to use for logistics reasons or communication, but the families are then moved and billeted elsewhere. They're not kept in the home with the soldiers, which if they take your house probably isn't a very satisfactory thing. Now, you might not see the distinction, but there is one. Amendment 4, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Does anybody know which amendment to the Constitution completely destroyed that amendment? 16th Amendment, because in order to tax you the way the federal government taxes you, they have to go through all of your papers, accounts, know everything about you. Completely destroyed the protection zone under Amendment 4 when Amendment 16 was passed. You are supposed to be guaranteed the right of privacy to your home, businesses, and private papers. The last thing that really destroyed the Fourth Amendment and some of the amendments afterwards was the Patriot Act and the so-called Department of Homeland Security. Those things are absolutely a violation of everything in the Bill of Rights, and very, very few people ever questioned it. And when they first initiated the Patriot Act, we were guaranteed that it was for emergency purposes only. Been a long emergency, hasn't it? And I see it going on for a lot longer unless we make some changes. And when it says no warrant without probable cause means that someone who is a reliable witness, generally more than one witness, has seen activity that they can describe well enough to convince officers that there's probable cause for a search. That was what probable cause for a search warrant was. Hasn't been that in a long time, but that is what probable cause was. Let's look at Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment of or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. It was just about a year and a half ago that the Supreme Court ruled that the government can institute eminent domain any time that they feel that your land can be used for a better purpose. That's what the Supreme Court decision boiled down to. Now, the states have been practicing a little bit of nullification in that area, and I believe Missouri is one of the states that has done so. It says, no, you cannot take land from a private person to put to the use of another private person. You can only use eminent domain if it is actually in the use of some publicly needed project, like a highway, if somebody doesn't want to let their land go for a highway. A capital crime, by definition, is one that can bring the death penalty. An infamous crime is any crime that is severe enough to bring death or imprisonment. And a lot of crimes can bring imprisonment. A grand jury consists of 12 to 23 people called together by the sheriff or a United States Marshal to hear witnesses tell their story to the jury, and a jury will either return a true bill, which means they believe the witnesses, that is then an indictment, or a no bill, meaning they don't believe the witnesses, and there's no reason for a warrant to be issued or an indictment. Most states don't use grand juries. About the only people who use grand juries anymore are the federal government, and they only use them when they need a media dog and pony show. They do not use them for the purpose that they were designed. Not supposed to be double jeopardy. We all know about that one. No self-incrimination can be compelled. You are to have due process, meaning you are to be brought forward, have the charges against you read, made clear to you. All of those things are supposed to be followed in the United States of America.
The 16th Amendment also knocked out the 5th Amendment.
Sure, the 16th Amendment knocked out the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th Amendments.
You incriminate yourself with the thing, with your papers that you're holding. They take those and then you incriminate yourself and they make you.
The book that had this case in it, I have loaned to somebody, so I couldn't get enough of specifics back into my head, but I know enough that I'll give you a bare bones of it. Right here in Kansas City, an elderly couple was taken before a tax judge. That tax judge slid in front of them a wide-open confession, pre-prepared, and ordered them to sign that confession. That confession said that they were agreeing that anything that the IRS charged these people with, no matter what, they were guilty of. And he told that elderly couple that you will sign that or I will imprison you today. They talked it over, stood on their Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, and did not sign it. That judge had the federal marshals take that elderly couple directly to the federal penitentiary in Leavenworth, where they were imprisoned for a year. A year until...
Dave, real quick, just one interjection.
Yep.
The man who was taken in front of this, quote, magistrate... said, I will sign it, rights reserved under the Constitution. In other words, he said, I will sign it, rights reserved. And the federal magistrate looked him straight in the eye and said, you don't understand, in this courtroom you have no constitutional rights. That straight up is what was said.
But that couple was in that prison for a year until the media got a hold of the story finally, and that couple was let out of prison, and they were never afterwards charged with any tax evasion or violations.
Yeah, they weren't compensated off that either, were they?
No. But a United States judge ordered a couple falsely imprisoned. Two federal marshals violated their oath to uphold and defend the Constitution by taking that couple to the prison, and that warden was guilty of aiding and abetting in kidnapping and false imprisonment when he put them in that prison. Now guess how many of those people got charged with a crime? None. We think of things like that as an extreme case, and it may have been a very extreme case of a judge gone wrong, but I'm telling you right now, hundreds of people per day in the United States are abused in similar fashion by the Internal Revenue Service and the tax system. The Internal Revenue Service absolutely will tell you you are guilty until you overwhelmingly prove your innocence when they charge you with something.
When did this happen? Recently?
No. Late 90s, wasn't it?
This has been around 10 years ago.
What was the name of the couple, do you remember?
Warren and Shirley Black.
Warren and Shirley Black.
You can go look their case up on the internet.
Warren and Shirley Black.
The judge had them out of there before the media, before the marshals, before anybody knew it. Because it was being exposed, 5462, Channel 9, national outlets were all sitting outside Leavenworth waiting for them to come out, and the marshals didn't even know the release order had come. It hit so fast and so hard that the judge literally scared, and the marshals were angry. But the problem with it is, and the good thing is, guys, they were falsely imprisoned, but there's no telling how many people came to a knowledge of Christ while they were in prison.
Yeah, God uses everything, but I'd prefer that he not have to use our government's violations. And like I said before, the eminent domain thing, there's no such thing as private property in the United States anymore, not according to the federal government. Let's look at Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining the witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Actually, one of my favorite movies, a cop is arresting a guy, and he tells him, you have the right to remain silent. If you cannot afford an attorney, we will hire you the dumbest attorney that ever graduated from law school, which is probably the truth. The trial by jury in your home state and district has been violated a great deal, and I suspect will be violated a great deal more because the federal government has taken on more and more authority in so many places that they claim the right to try you, and they take you out of your state somewhere else. They do everything they can to make your trial inconvenient, to make it a hardship. We do not have a justice system in the United States. I said that before. We had a justice system. Today we have a legal system. They're not at all the same thing. Amendment 7. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Folks, there's no such thing as a trial for anything below $20. Not today, yet we don't have jury trials. What the government has done is claim that administrative law is separate from common law. Administrative law does not require juries, judges. It allows the administrative departments of the government to be the judge, jury, and executioner and fine or imprison you at will. That is what administrative law is. It began with the IRS. They've had it for years. Actually, it could have gone back to the Interstate Commerce Commission, but I don't think they were pulling those things back in 1877. But certainly from the IRS on, groups like the IRS, the ATF, EPA, Federal Trade Commission, all of these administrative groups can haul you before an individual or a panel, tell you you're guilty of something, and fine you or imprison you with no trial. They have been violating the Bill of Rights terribly for a long time. Amendment 8, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. I think for the most part, those are probably adhered to. The really big bails are for people who may skip to another country. The other thing that means is, under these laws, a judge cannot substitute his opinion in place of the jury's opinion. And an appellate court cannot set aside jury findings and make their own final order. They can declare a mistrial, but no one can set aside a jury's findings, which is why the government doesn't want you to have jury trials. How many people have ever heard of a jury trial for someone accused of tax evasion? And how many people do you think would be convicted of tax evasion if they had jury trials? Amendment 9 was an important one. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The founders knew they couldn't list every right that we have under God. And they made sure with this Amendment 9 to say that the people will tell you what other rights they have. You won't tell them. It's exactly what Amendment 9 means. Amendment 10, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay, which amendment gutted this one? 17th Amendment gutted this one. It used to be the state legislatures appointed senators, and the senator's sole job in Washington, D.C. was to counteract the House of Representatives and populist legislation when it was going to override the rights and powers of the states. That is why the federal government wanted senators to be directly elected. They are now a subsidiary of the House of Representatives.
Right. And the senators could be recalled by the
legislatures, yes.
At a moment's notice, they would be brought home and subsequently sat down. This is still happening. The states are working on that right now.
We badly need to repeal the 16th and 17th Amendments. We need to rewrite the 14th Amendment. The reason for it was good, but it's an incredibly poorly written amendment. It needs to be shortened and to the point. But the 16th and 17th Amendments absolutely need to be repealed if we want this nation to be what it's supposed to be. So I'm going to talk real quick about two cases. And the reason I'm going to talk about this is George Washington said the Second Amendment was the teeth in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. And I'm going to talk about two cases that revolved around firearms and the United States government. First one was in 1992, a place called Ruby Ridge. A gentleman named Randy Weaver. Randall Weaver was a family man. He was a veteran, and he had no criminal record. The government was hot in Idaho to infiltrate the militia, who they were sure were just out to overthrow the government right now. They were right, but nobody was actually calling for a march on Washington at the time. Anyway, a federal informant got Randall Weaver to sell him two shotguns, which is not illegal. Got Randall Weaver to saw those two shotguns down for him. Federal agents came back and told him that those two shotguns had been sawed down a quarter of an inch shorter than the legal allowed limit. And they wanted him to work for them to infiltrate the Aryan nations and give them information. And they were so weird and so vague, he said, forget it. So they charged him. Well, he was indicted. He was supposed to go to trial over those weapons. That was his one big mistake. He just didn't go to the trial. Since he missed the trial, the government had a federal warrant issued for his arrest, and they based it on labeling him a weapons trafficker. Now, I don't know what your definition of weapons trafficker would be, but two shotguns probably ain't it. They had the warrant, and they never arrested the man. Instead, for a year and a half, the federal government staked out his cabin. At an average cost of $13,000 a week, the government talked a lot to the media. They labeled Randall Weaver a racist, a criminal, and a radical extremist in the media. The plywood cabin he had in Iowa became a mountain fortress and bunker. On August 21st of 1992, federal agents in camouflage gear, masks over their faces, hiding out in the woods of the Weaver acreage. Sammy Weaver, 14 years old, a friend of his, Kevin Harris, are hunting. Dog starts running and barking. They think it's found squirrels, found something. All of a sudden, shots ring out, and the dog's dead. Sammy Weaver's scared. He fires a shot in the direction of where the shots came from and turns and runs. As that 14-year-old is running, a federal agent shoots him in the back and kills him. Kevin Harris then returned a shot. He's scared. Well, he hits Marshall and mortally wounds him, Marshall Dillon. Later that night, Kevin and Randy, in the dark, bring Sammy's body back near the home. The marshals who are there lie and claim that they were pinned down by the Weavers with gunfire for 8 hours. As a consequence, the house is then surrounded by BATF, FBI, federal marshals, Idaho State Police, local police, and the Idaho National Guard. The head of the FBI hostage rescue team on site changes the normal hostage procedure because they're claiming that the Weaver children are hostages. That's why they need all these people there. Instead of any kind of negotiations, the orders become kill on sight, any adult that you can see. Nobody attempted in any way to contact or negotiate any of the people in the house. An FBI sniper wounds Randy Weaver. I don't have the name of the one that shot Randy Weaver. I don't think they know for sure. But I know who shot the wife. It was Ronald Horiucci. A sniper by the name of Ron Horiucci looks through his scope, sees Vicki Weaver. That's what he said. She was standing in the doorway holding a baby. He saw an unarmed woman with a baby in her arms, and he shot and killed her. The family that was still surviving, the rest of the people there, holed up, surrounded for a week while the FBI used different negotiations tactics. They taunted the people for that entire week. On August 30th, Kevin Harris went out and was arrested, and they charged him with the murder of the marshal. Weaver was arrested, and they had a big, big media zoo. They're going to show this guy's arsenal. This guy's arsenal was smaller than a farmer keeps in his basement. He just had a few normal legal weapons. The long shot was Kevin Harris, the 14-year-old, was acquitted of any charges, all charges, murder. Randy Weaver, when he went to court, was found not guilty of 8 felony charges. The only thing the jury found him guilty of was not appearing in court and violating bail. Subsequent investigation by different organizations, including Congress, showed that FBI had falsified evidence. The shoot-to-kill order was a violation of procedure. Now, here's the one I love. The Senate, in its wisdom, decided that Vicki Weaver's killing was a violation of her constitutional rights. They would not call it murder. They called it a violation of her constitutional rights. The media ignored the story once the truth began to come out. None of the government officials involved in that fiasco was censured, demoted. No one ever charged with anything. Randall Weaver did get a $3 million settlement, but what's that? You've lost your wife. You've lost a child. But if you add that $3 million up with the $3 million they spent on surveillance plus what they probably spent on the court, a man who was alleged to have cut two shotguns a quarter inch short, the government spent somewhere between $7 and $10 million and two deaths. How you like that use of your tax money, folks? Yes, Horiuchi was also one of the shooters at Waco, and we're going to talk about Waco now. Waco and David Koresh. David Koresh was born Vernon Wayne Howell. When they talk about him, you know, he's been accused of child molestation. He's dead. There's no way to ever know that one way or another. If he was, then it was something he should have been arrested for. He should have been convicted of. But we're never going to know that. He was an odd man. There's no doubt about it. Their religious ideas were pretty strange. But it's not illegal to have strange religious ideas. Koresh bought and sold guns and gun parts. He made paperweights and knickknacks out of inert grenade holes. That's how he funded the compound there, the Branch Davidian compound. He did assemble guns from parts that he bought, but he sold those guns through a licensed dealer. He collected a lot of semi-auto firearms for investment and, yes, for protection. He did fear the government. He did want protection for his compound. But all of the things that he did in that regard were legal. In 1992, a UPS driver reported delivering firearm parts and explosives to the compound. And nobody's ever said for sure what the explosives were. We do know that he bought black powder. The BATF opened an investigation on that after that report from the UPS driver. They did find that Koresh had purchased flare launchers, over 100 rifles, an M76 grenade launcher, black powder, and practice grenades and some other things, but everything he had bought was legal. He had bought nothing that was a Class 3 firearm or Class 3 explosive, which means that there was no probable cause to believe him to have violated or having the intent to violate any federal law. To obtain warrants for search and arrest, the agents in charge, Skinner and Aguilera, never disclosed that during conversations with an intermediary, Koresh had invited them to visit and inspect his weapons and his facility, no warrant needed. They didn't inform the magistrate that they had refused to do that. Without probable cause, the BATF wanted to look for items that, if assembled, might be illegal.
Didn't they claim him to have receiver parts or an automatic weapon?
The receiver parts they talked about, the A2 parts, could be used for an automatic or a semi-automatic weapon, AR-15 style. Aguilera misled Magistrate Dennis Green to be able to get the warrants both before and after the raid. Aguilera's statements were filled with inaccuracies and lies. He was the agent in charge. The BATF even infiltrated the compound with Special Agent Robert Rodriguez, who never found or reported anything illegal, and he was inside the compound. But Aguilera wanted the BATF to get Koresh for something. February 28, 1993, out of the blue, 76 BATF agents stormed the compound, fully armed. Four of those agents were killed and somewhere between 14 and 28 wounded. Reports suggest that the majority of the wounds came from shooting one another. A 51-day siege followed. Some adults and children left the compound. In violation of all hostage negotiation protocol, agents used nuisance tactics. They played loud music, made abrasive noises, and taunted the people in the compound by bullhorn. The media labeled the initial self-defense of the compound against heavily armed federal agents an ambush. Now, unless David Koresh called Aguilera and said, I want you to bring 76 guys in, but bring them right here in this spot, there wasn't any ambush. The people just responded to an armed assault. Attorney General Janet Reno orders an assault on that compound, knowing that there are 25 children inside. On April 19th of 1993, CEV tanks start firing at the compound, pumping in large gas rounds. The kind of gas rounds that knock holes in walls. These are miniature tanks. As they were doing the tank firing, though, FBI agent Byron Sage shouts over the loudspeaker, "This is not an assault. Don't shoot back." Bet they liked that one. They did wind up firing back. The shelling continued. The compound caught fire and exploded. Killed all but nine of the people in the compound. The tougher thing about Waco is that enough claims have been made by both sides about wrongdoing that it gets real hazy. But here's some things that you can look at. One question you can ask yourself, no matter where you're at, is why did federal agents practice an assault on the compound for months when they could have arrested David Koresh when he was out jogging or in town shopping? Number two, why did they need an element of surprise when Koresh had always cooperated with authorities in the past when there had been problems on the compound? and when he had offered to let them in and inspect? And why did Aguilera pursue warrants to the point of lying when there was never any evidence of illegal activity? You know, I would submit to you that both Ruby Ridge and Waco occurred because a government and administration so badly wanted two major media dog and pony shows that they could use to get people on board the idea of disarming American citizens. The good thing for American citizens is they botched these so badly and the truth came out, the gun sales went through the roof. And people who had never thought about owning guns were suddenly buying them. Yes, sir.
Both those cases, why did the county sheriff not be held accountable by the people of that county for allowing that to transpire in that county?
Mainly because it's one of the reasons we're having this class. People have forgotten that we have rights. You've been to listen to Sheriff Mack talk, and you know that the majority of sheriffs don't even realize the power they have. Majority of citizens don't realize the power we have. I'm going to leave you with three thoughts, though, about the Second Amendment. Three thoughts that I want you to ponder. If guns kill people, then pencils misspell words. Automobiles cause accidents and drunk driving, and spoons made me fat. Yes, ma'am.
What were the actual dates of the murders on these?
It was April 19th, 1993 that the tanks rolled on the Branch Davidian compound. It was August 21st of 92 at Ruby Ridge that shots were fired. But the truth is, and we've talked about this over a four-week period, the problems in our government did not start in the 60s or 70s. The problem at the federal level began with the conclusion of the Civil War, when the federal government, the balance that was supposed to be between the states and the federal government, tilted toward the Fed after the Civil War, and it never tilted back. And it's tilted more and more all the time. List of suggested reading materials. I listed these books in a list of importance. The Bible being number one. The Bible was the number one thing that influenced the founders. It was the number one thing that developed Western civilization's thought for centuries leading up to the Declaration of Independence. Any of the writings of the founding fathers. Those things are more important than all of the books that have been written since. Because the founding fathers were there, they knew exactly what they meant, intended, when they wrote the Declaration of the Constitution and a Bill of Rights. The 5,000-Year Leap by Cleon Skousen, that book lays out in a very easy-to-understand manner the 28 principles contained in the Constitution. The next book, Making of America by Cleon Skousen, I think took him about 30 years of research because he goes through the Constitution line by line with quotes from the founders, questions the founders were asking as they wrote each of those lines in the Constitution. He makes it very clear what everything in the Constitution means. America's History Revealed by Philip W. Winkler. It's not a thick book. It's easy to understand. He has a lot of good history, basic economics, but he did for the Declaration of Independence what Skousen did with the Constitution. Winkler breaks down the Declaration of Independence in small fragments of clauses to show the interdependence between the Constitution and the Declaration and how they can't be separated. Patriot's Guide to Taking America Back by Charles Kraut. Great American Political Thinkers, Volume 1 and 2. It's been around for a long time, edited by Richard Brown. I used those books in college back in the 80s. They are two very good volumes if you want to understand what the political thinkers were writing and talking about. County Sheriff, America's Last Hope by Richard Mack. From My Cold Dead Fingers by Richard Mack. If you've never listened to him, he was the sheriff who challenged the Brady Bill and won in the Supreme Court. Two information websites, nccs.net, that's the National Center for Constitutional Studies, and wallbuilders.com. Both of those websites look at things differently. David Barton's looking at things very, very much from a Christian perspective on wall builders. I like nccs.net, unlike some of the others, because they are completely apolitical. They are not about any party. They're strictly about constitutional studies. And then I wrote down here the homework that I finally expect you to do coming out of this class. I have given you the website for the four political parties that are officially on the ballot in the state of Missouri each election. Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, and Constitution Party. Those are the four on the ballot. I want you to look those parties up and I want you to read their platforms. Now, we've had 4 weeks where we talked about Christianity as the bedrock, the absolute bedrock of the nation. If you read those parties' platforms and they don't have anything to do with Christianity, we're in trouble. The Declaration of Independence is the foundation. If you read those platforms and they don't look at all to the Declaration of Independence in any way, there's a problem. Constitution is the framework. If they don't mention the Constitution anywhere in their platform, which is what they're going to swear an oath to uphold and defend if they represent you, there's a problem. And the Bill of Rights as the walls. If none of those things can be found in a party's platform, there's a problem. If you can find a party that has those things in its platform and you truly believe those things are what this nation needs, then I'm going to be politically incorrect and tell you if you don't join that party, you're a fool. Because we will not take our nation back without taking a stand on our own moral convictions and beliefs. And I will say that I do agree with George Carlin. During one of his little screeds, his comedy routines, he asked the audience if they knew why in the United States we have ignorant, greedy, incompetent representatives. And he said it's because, as an electorate, we are ignorant, greedy, and incompetent. And they reflect our values. Well, I want to see him start reflecting some other values. Take a stand.